Well, my impression has been that, certainly there was a change in the strength of the faculty in regard to some other source of control of the School of Education and the general operation of the university. Somewhere in the 60s, when there was a tremendous influx again of younger, new faculty. But this is perhaps the first time that somebody has indicated to me that there was also a change right after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give a little more detail about how Mr. Willing and Mr. Ragsdale were apart somehow from the rest of you? Just, weren't you being indoctrinated into the Wisconsin idea and so on and so forth?
Well, this is where I think there may have been a mistake in tactics by Willing and Ragsdale. I think they were using confrontation tactics with the administration, which really bypassed the younger faculty at the time, where instead of confronting, they could have used more positive ways of bringing us along and, in a sense, educating us.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I think they jumped an important educational role that they could have, those two persons could have had with younger faculty. Mm-hmm. Now, it may indeed have been that the other older faculty at the time weren't as concerned about faculty control. And it may be that Willing and Ragsdale had their confrontations with their own peers and, in a sense, went to this confrontation politics sort of thing on the basis of their experience with their peers who really didn't care about control.
Mm-hmm.
I really can't say for sure on that. But I would expect that had those of us who were new at the time been, and let's put it this way, properly socialized
mm-hmm.
into faculty control that really was the tradition of the University of Wisconsin, we might indeed have gone along more fully with Willing and Ragsdale.
Mm-hmm.
We just didn't do it. Yeah. We were frightened by it, if anything.
Right. Well, it's understandable considering that probably a great many of you weren't tenured.
Even if we were tenured early,
mm-hmm.
We still were not comfortable in confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it, I guess what I'm saying is that had I understood the traditions of governance in Wisconsin, which redeveloped several times during my tenure here,
mm-hmm.
To the point where I believe I understand now that there is a role one can play as a faculty member, as a department, as an executive committee,
mm-hmm.
that indeed is more powerful than a dean.
Mm-hmm.
So we just didn't understand it at that time. Mm-hmm. I wasn't socialized to that. Maybe it took 25 years,
mm-hmm.
Because nobody was really helping.
I get the impression from what you're saying that in the old Department of Education, particularly in the few years right after World War II, that outside of the fact that the dean had extremely strong control, that what power there was in the department resided primarily in the uppermost parts of the executive committee.
You're right. Right. That I think that's a good way of summarizing that. There was such a new influx of people at that time that the old timers really control the department. Now, a few of them moved into controlling functions faster than others. I believe Chet Harris moved in rather fast. Chet moved in fast for the simple reason that he was an absolutely brilliant interpreter of events.
Mm-hmm.
He could see what was going on faster. There's no question about it.
let's see if I remember, was Harris one of the people brought in from Chicago?
Yes, he was brought in from Chicago. Herrick. I believe he and Herrick may have come about 47, I'm not sure, you know, about that time. And they may have been brought in, you know, if they came earlier than that, they may have brought in associate professors.
Fox expressly went and got them.
Yes, right, right. So my guess is they came in as associate professors. And again, both of them brilliant. In quite different ways. Both of them had the intellectual qualities not quite as tempered with, neither of them were soft. I'm going to have to put the tempering here. They really weren't tempered with the kind of concern for students on a personal level that many of the others had. There were a set group of identifiable group of individuals, let's put it this way, that could cause almost every female grad student to bawl. At almost, you'd know which professor they had seen. It'd be one of two or three if you'd see them crying in the hall.
Mm-hmm.
There were pressures in those days, and there were people who didn't use what I would call appropriate tactics to bring crises through without a kind of a breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And I say female students because, you know, females cry faster than males. Males would go out swearing. We've been, you know, socialized to that.
Mm-hmm.
So both Chet Harris and Virge Herrick were able to do that without even understanding why.
Mm-hmm. Did it cause you to lose students as a result?
No, it took a bit of my time.
Uh-huh.
Because I happened to be a soft-shouldered person.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I would... it's happened to me too. I've caused, you know, I've had people break down and cry in my office. Not many,
mm-hmm.
but I think what happened is I got a reputation very early that I would listen to students with problems.
Mm-hmm.
A few others did the same thing. A.S. Barr was the one that really pulled students out of the doldrums. Sure, he was, you know, he was thought of as being pretty soft. Don't know if anyone else has mentioned that to you. And what tends to happen is one thinks because one is concerned about the personal problems of students, and there may be a correlation, but very often the correlation is, well, they're soft in all respects on students. And A.S. Barr had that reputation too, and yet some of the best people that came out of here were A.S. Barrs.
Mm-hmm.
So, Barr would take the brunt of the people that had run-ins with Chester Harris, because it usually was on statistics and evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd go to Barr. And Barr would, he had his desk piled up twice as high as I do in my office. He could always find everything. He would always take time to talk to the harassed students.
Mm-hmm.
He would always make statistics seem easy, even though they knew it was hard. And Harris would almost always make them end up believing it was hard. There's only one person that teaches statistics on campus now that reminds me of the way Barr taught it. That's a guy over in ag journalism, Dick Powers. Dick Powers can make students believe that statistics is easy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And both Barr and Powers are good statisticians. Where, you know, Powers is, and Barr was a good statistician.
Mm-hmm. Going on to a sort of another vignette. There's another interesting sort of thing. You were acquiring funding from the Office of Education already in the late 50s and as early as 1958, mm-hmm. Even before all the great education acts began mm-hmm. their passage. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how you were able to do so, and and since you've continued looking for those funds up to the present, how the process has changed with respect to individual professor level and general.
Yeah, since I think you have here, and I wouldn't be sure of the date, you have 58 was the first time I got funds?
Well,
it was in that. It was in the late 50s.
Particular.
Okay.
Business.
There were a couple things involved in it at that point. These were the early, the very first of the research funds coming out of the U.S. Office of Education. Now, I don't think there's any question, there's no question in my mind of why I got funds early and why the proposals I submitted in competition were funded. It's because I was requesting funds on follow-up of the school reorganization study. I'd been on it since 1949-50, the first year I was here. I had reports that were out. I had a plan that showed where it started, showed where it was going to go. I had a major researchable thrust that had researchable pieces in it. I could identify very clearly what I wanted to do with the money, and I would say I was in an ideal position to compete for funds where the requests were reviewed by panels. Very frankly, in a much better position at that point, and over a period of about 6-8 years, than at any time in my career.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was the ideal time, and there were very few funds available. So I really got funds when funds were hard to get, although as far as I was concerned, they weren't hard to get,
mm-hmm.
because I had everything going for me. So that was the way I got them then. Now, over the years, as you're aware, the funding has changed. I was still dealing with the same kind of a basically a longitudinal study. It was having its tangents, as I indicated in the earlier tape. And there were other things that I was involved in relation to it. Even the reorganization study, and here's another tangent I didn't talk about the other day, was developing another tangent that I wanted to explore, which I did when the R&D Center came to Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Now let me give you a quick, because that's the way I continued funds on a tangent of reorganization and a bit of reorganization itself. The way we got the R&D Center at Wisconsin. There were two proposals for R&D centers when R&D centers were up for competition.
Mm-hmm.
Stiles was dean at the time, and I was in Washington in 63-64 on a jointly funded research project, part of it funded by the U.S. Office of Education, part by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and I think a piece of it, at least certain of expenses and so on, by the university. So it was a three-pronged thing. Well, I was there while R&D centers were being developed. The legislation had come through, and it was a matter of developing them. So that I was in a sense in a close relationship with what was going on in the U.S. Office of Education. Herb Klausmeier was developing a project on cognitive learning. And Herb is really a top-notch researcher, had top-notch ideas, and had a very good idea for an R&D center.
Mm-hmm.
We were at a stage where we had gotten funds for National Defense Education Act fellowships for adult education. In the early 60s, we had, in fact, it may have been as early as 59 or 60. We had about 8 or 10 grad students on these. I think we had probably 11 in all. All of them have finished their PhDs, by the way, who came during that period. And so it was adult education was being recognized in the U.S. Office of Education. And so I was preparing a plan and a budget for an R&D center on adult education. Klausmeier was preparing one on cognitive learning. There was some initial screening, and certain other proposals were out as far as federal competition was concerned. But both the the adult education and the cognitive learning were still being considered. And Dean Stiles, I think, recognized from his administrative role that there was no way Wisconsin would get two. I mean, that was clear politically. There was a concern that he had, and I think rightly, that with two in the competition, maybe Wisconsin wouldn't get either. And so Stiles and Herb were in Washington for something, both at the same time, and we had a conference. I recognized that from my contacts there, that really the odds of getting an adult education R&D center at that time were really slimmer than getting one on cognitive learning. Mm-hmm. Adult education, true, was coming into its own, but it was in the early stages. The whole thrust on elementary and secondary education, the thrust on cognition and so on, was really much more in line for an R&D center. So Stiles was concerned about how we could integrate these two. And as far as I was concerned, true, it would be nice to have had to have set it up so that it was equal, but you had to emphasize something. So I'm sure that Herb and Stiles, and I just don't remember the details of it, probably twisted my arm, but if they did it so kindly it didn't hurt. Mm-hmm. To put the emphasis on cognitive learning and keep a piece of a community change, which was a new tangent that was coming out of my reorganization study, which was adult-oriented, and some adult education. So it became a small piece, really, of the R&D Center, and it was titled at that time Research and Development Center on Cognitive Learning and Re-Education. Mm-hmm. I don't know who coined that. That's not one I normally use. Mm-hmm. But it got away, I think it got away from adult education as such so that we could drop that proposal, which we did. And mm-hmm. then, so the university put in a single proposal, mm-hmm. Which was funded. And for a period of, well, I stayed on the R&D Center 5 years on this follow-up of the reorganization research on the tangent on community change. Mm-hmm. There were a number of us dealing with this. Max Goodson,
Hagstrom.
Warren Hagstrom, particularly. Then we had a couple people at advanced levels, project associates, who were ed administration people, but were really involved in community change and in interpersonal relations, as Goodson was involved in. So we sort of all worked together on this, but the one thing I was doing at the time was following up the reorganization study and had funding for that, but was pretty much going on some theoretical research on community change. And this all went back to the process of reorganization, where we really saw a kind of a cyclical system going on socially, mm-hmm. or sociologically. And so in a sense, I was really dealing with some very theoretical research at the time. Coming out with a model for educational improvement, which is still viable. It's still being used in a number of researches elsewhere. I still follow up pieces of it. I did some follow-up on it in England and in Taiwan in 70-71, which was a follow-up of the R&D Center stuff. Also got myself over my depth on a project there where I was going too psychological. Was really trying to do a psychological awareness of change. Mm-hmm. And finally got to the point where my assistant, Millie Marin, and I admitted to each other one day that both of us were out of our depth. So I went to, I think Herb was, well, both, I think Max and Herb were co-directors. I probably went to Max first. He was a little easier to talk to. Herb was also very understanding. And Herb knew the psychological stuff much better than I did. And I just told him the only way I could continue that one was to spend a couple of years learning more about psychology. And I said I wasn't about to do it. He said, why don't you write up a final report and exit it, mm-hmm. which I did. I even put it out in a little publication. I even forget the title of it. So Herb and Max were interesting administrators when they were co-administrators. In fact, that almost goes back to the concept. No, I'm not going to bring it up. I've got too many other things to cover.
Well, that your last comment though does suggest something that you might talk a little bit about. Potential changes in the structuring of the administration operation of the R&D Center itself. After all, that's become rather a large part of the School of Education's operation.
Yeah. I haven't been close to it since 1970.
Oh, okay.
So I really have not followed it explicitly okay. since then.
Okay. In that case, perhaps move on to one of those large, significant milestones in the school's history, the reorganization of the School of Education, one of those myriad of reorganizations that one goes through.
Yeah.
Perhaps you can talk to that a little bit.
I'm never really, okay, I'll talk about it a little bit. Mm-hmm. I would not identify myself as a person deeply involved in trying to make those changes. Other than to get a solid base for adult education.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about that the other day in the development of CAPE.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a involved party, just as a professor, mm-hmm. as this was going on, indeed I have some perceptions of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was not in the driver's seat, nor even trying to take any leadership in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's from that aspect that
okay.
I'll give it. The Department of Education, as it was growing, it was really growing during the early post-war period, World War II period, and of course a lot of the size increasing in the 60s when more funds were continually coming. You know, you'd request additional staff and you'd get it. It wasn't that you requested additional staff when you didn't need it. I guess my own reaction to this always is, at that point, when a professor was developing new areas, as we were doing in those days, and was putting in more than a normal amount of work, maybe the equivalent of a professor and a half,
mm-hmm.
at that point, it seemed very appropriate to request an additional staff person. And in those days, when you could show that that indeed was what you're doing, you got it. This is the way, for example, when we moved Thede in from Extension. It had gotten to the point where I was doing more than I should have been doing. I was doing a full job of adult education and a half a job of rural. So we got Thede in. A few years later, same thing was true when we brought Boyd in. Thede and I were doing more than a single professor should, either than two single professors should be doing, and we made the request for funds and we got it. We did the very same thing when Wayne Otto came in, because Wayne came in to both reading and adult education. I don't know if you were aware of that. And once he got into the R&D Center and got really engaged in research, he made the choice, and I think a wise one, he pulled out of adult education and put all of his focus on reading.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what is happening. So the department was growing. The department was not getting unmanageable. but it was unmanageable in terms of the reawakening of faculty governance. And you know, a small department can operate democratically. It's my judgment. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say you know, maybe you don't know. A small department can operate democratically with a lot of involvement, with far less spinning of wheels and wasted motion than a large department.
Mm-hmm.
The large Department of Education was really spinning, and it was spinning because in terms of democratic participation, we were clustering.
Mm-hmm.
Elementary education was big enough, so in sense, it had its own kind of unit within a unit. Some of the special fields, science, whether it was elementary or secondary, math and so on, were all getting big enough so that their real governance really had to do with their own programs rather than the department. Guidance and counseling was the same way. So size had an awful lot to do with this. And then once you start making recommendations for pulling out a particular group, now, which one went out first? Administration?
Ed Psych.
Ed Psych, okay. Ed Psych indeed was, I suppose I would say, in its disunity, was in a better position to be united, in a sense, to have their own governance. Because
mm-hmm.
they were not unified, they were in conflict. But who wanted their conflict in the Department of Education? You know, let them have their governance on the outside. To me, that was a piece of it. It was kind of nice when they pulled out. Let's put it that way. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's much better that they run themselves than run the department or disrupt the department.
Mm-hmm.
And they were large enough to form their own group. I don't know what ideal size is, but I guess I would say that if there were only four or five people, it's too small.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get up to 8 or 10 or more, run up to 20, it's probably pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the research, for example, that people do with groups and democratic participation, they usually end up saying 12 to 15.
Mm-hmm.
Becomes a good, viable group. Bob Boyd's research, for example, shows that. So that, in a sense, there was a recognition that we were too big. That almost was a given. Now, some people didn't want people pulling out, you know, we're going to lose our unity.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, I guess I would say that sure, we lost some unity by splitting off, but we were losing unity in the department anyway. So, you know, I don't think there's any control that could tell us we would have lost more or less
mm-hmm.
because of the split up. So Ed Psych pulled out, then it became only a matter of time. In other words, once that breakthrough occurred, and I guess it was a breakthrough, then there was a recognition all the way through, okay, which is going to be the next group to go?
Mm-hmm.
And it, in a sense, followed that pattern. I was involved to some extent, but almost in an acquiescent way, to Ed Policy Studies pulling out. I was involved in you know the community backgrounds of education, issues in rural education, which had a sociological implications. Sociology is one of the bases of Ed Policy Studies. And the courses I had taught in program development, I had left as new staff came in because Thede took over that role. And being the only one in adult education, practically all the basic courses I developed in the early years.
Mm.
And then we just, people came in to take them over. So I really ended up back with the overview course in adult education, question where should that go? And since it, again, had a kind of a social base, Ed Policy Studies, and the rural stuff, Ed Policy Studies. So I fell naturally in with that group. Even though my own scholarship, my own research, usually had more of a applied thrust than people in philosophy and history and so on. did. All right. I was just talking about the formation of ed policy studies. Now, most of the work on ed policy studies to really get them together occurred the year I was in Washington, 63, 64. And so a number of times I would have to fill out forms and send back, or I'd get a call from Merle Borrowman or someone like that in terms of the directions the department was going, and I'd get the minutes of the meetings. So the actual involvement, I'd really made my decision in advance of that. I think I had to actually declare it in writing at one time. I sort of half remember having to do that. And at that point, I did not pull out of, see, Ed Administration was formed about the same time, wasn't it?
Very,
it was so close that I had not pulled out of Ed Administration for the simple reason that I had some advisees in rural education still continuing. Really chose, when the department was being split up, to get their degree in Ed Administration, because rural education then had to be identified with something. Mm-hmm. So rural education was identified with administration, but the courses were identified with Ed Policy Studies for the most part. So that probably for a period up until probably even as late as 1969-70, I still had the tag ends of my PhD advisees in Ed Ad. And so I stayed in that department until I made a formal request to get out. I was no longer teaching in the department. CNI was basically the same way. I had some people whose theses were primarily curriculum, program development. And rather than have them move into Ed Policy Studies, they chose to stay in CNI. And so I maintained that in CNI. And as I may have indicated to you yesterday, at one time I requested to be dropped from CNI, but I think it was oral. And I don't to this day know if I'm officially dropped. I don't show up on their rosters, but I get a lot of their mail.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I may be between the cracks in CNI. Then in this goes back to other changes, you see, which began in 64 and are still going on. When CAVE was formed, most of my advisees, CAVE was formed in 74,
mm-hmm.
And most of my advisees from Ed Policy Studies chose to move their degree to CAVE, with a couple of exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the exceptions finished their work in Ed Policy Studies, but still had the special field of adult education. The I'm not on the budget. I dropped totally from the budget of Ed Policy Studies when CAVE was formed, but have joint appointments.
Mm-hmm.
And in the mid, about 70, I think 75, the last of my Ed Policy adult education persons finished their doctorates. I have, usually have, one or two straight Ed Policy advisees,
mm-hmm.
where they're looking at social issues, where they're adult-oriented. In fact, one just finished this semester with whatever the term is used in Ed Policy, social issues, I think, an adult education minor.
Mm-hmm.
An interesting case. I don't know if the grad school is, if there's any rule against it, but I was both major and minor professor. Major in Ed Policies and minor in adult education.
Uh-huh.
That's one rule I didn't bother to ask because I was afraid the answer would be no. And so, you know, I'm sort of on the side of all of this. I've just flowed with the change.
Mm-hmm. Another of the large events in the early 60s that hit the school was the matter of the NCATE team coming mm-hmm. in and giving the School of Education Teacher Training Program provisional certification, and Dean Stiles not being happy with that, and so on and so forth. How did the faculty react to all that?
Okay, again, I'll give you my reaction. I'll give you the faculty reaction and my reaction. Mm-hmm. There were a few faculty that were really upset about it. Well, they were upset for two different reasons. One group was really upset with NCATE.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of trying to tell the university what to do, basically. And upset with NCATE because they claimed they didn't understand the Wisconsin system. And indeed, I think this was Stiles' position, although I'm sure he spoke for himself. Wisconsin has a somewhat different system of teacher education. And the way faculty from letters and science are part of the School of Education, they're not trained as educators as such, but, you know, basically they have a lot of input into the training of teachers. There was another group that was concerned because they were concerned that this whole thing in crisis might lead to the loss of ability for the university to certify teachers, or the State Department to certify teachers coming out of a school that wasn't approved by NCATE.
Mm-hmm.
They put their focus on the concern for the student. And I think they really believed that NCATE had the power to really do what they said they were going to do. I'm not sure Stiles believed that NCATE would ever do it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't believe NCATE would ever do it. And I think I was in the group that really felt it was an interesting controversy. You probably picked up from further comments. I've never said it outright to you. I believe controversy is an educational tool for adults.
Mm-hmm.
And that a good controversy every once in a while is an educational instrument. And I looked at the NCATE controversy as an educational instrument to the whole field of teacher education, and that it was stimulating on both sides, and that many of the faculty learned a lot about teacher education at Wisconsin and what it should be and the role of letters and science during that controversy.
Mm-hmm.
NCATE, in its infinite lack of wisdom at the time, learned an awful lot about alternative ways of certifying teachers. Stiles learned an awful lot, I believe, during that period of time on how to deal with external authority groups. He became a more astute politician during that period, but I think he had one hell of a time in dealing with that controversy because of the misinterpretations that always occur in controversy. It may even have been why he didn't want to go back to administration, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my own personal reaction, I sort of partly put that in,
mm-hmm.
was since I wasn't that close to it, I wasn't basically concerned with certification. That has not been my role.
Mm-hmm.
I almost tend to be anti-certification. So I really didn't think it was a major problem. I really felt it was going to get ironed out, that it might drag on for a while, but that basically Wisconsin had a system that was sound enough to prove, and that I thought it would end up that way, which it did. But I learned a lot. I learned a lot because it was a controversy.
Now, this is somewhat off from the last line of questioning, but perhaps you can talk a little bit about how the College of Agriculture and the School of Education contrast in the way they deal with things, since you've been involved in both. I think that would be interesting to get an idea of what goes on there.
Okay. I'll make a generalization, which is really based on less information from the College of Ag than from the School of Education.
Mm-hmm.
I am an educator, not an agricultural scientist.
Mm-hmm.
By reason of the role I play, I'm in both College of Ag and School of Education. The perception I have is that traditionally, in administrative matters, the College of Ag fits more of the pattern that John Guy Fawkes fit when he was dean. In other words, there is more authority resting in the dean's office in the College of Ag than is usually true in the School of Education. The faculty of the College of Ag are less concerned, with the exception of a few of the departments, Rural SOAS, Ag Economics, the old Ag and Extension Education, now part of CAVE, and some pieces of Home Ec, which are now out of the College of Ag, but which once were. They are a little more like, in a sense, have an affinity for the kinds of governance that tends to be a pattern in the School of Education. Mm-hmm. We're social scientists, not physical scientists, not biological scientists. Mm-hmm. And I think the difference is, if I were to judge why the difference occurs, is that the biological scientist, the agronomist, the soil scientist, the dairy scientist, just doesn't have the concern for the whole process of education and social action and so on that we get from people who are schooled in ed psych, in ed administration, in adult education, in, you know, CNI and so on. So I think it's almost a natural thing that there are differences there. Mm-hmm. They do like different departments like flexibility in the dean's office. I think they're more willing to accept arbitrary decisions at the dean's office. Times that I have dealt with administrators in ag versus administrators in education, if I get the word from the dean's office, I adjust to the word. If I get the word from the dean's office, that's in ag. If I get the word from the dean's office in education, I try to change it if I don't like it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's more potential flexibility over the years. Well, even with Fawkes, you'd go in and argue with him. Mm-hmm. So even under a situation when there was a lot of dean control, but you can do battle with the ag deans too. Mm-hmm. It's really more like the Fawkes situation over in ag. Mm-hmm. It really, if I were to compare it with any period, ag has maintained pretty much the kind of roles that Fawkes played without his personality. Over the years, while the School of Education, went from Fawkes to, well, Mayer was acting dean, and Stiles and McCarty and Palmer. Those deans in education do not compare at all with Froker and Pound. Mm-hmm. There's a different pattern of deanships. Again, I take Fawkes out of the pattern of education. Every once in a while, I think education needs a Fawkes, by the way. Interesting. I kind of felt that when McCarty left, we needed a Fawkes again. Mm-hmm. But we didn't get one. We've since Fawkes left, we've had the same pattern of deans. Mm-hmm. Some variations, but same pattern.
By pattern, you mean what?
Mild.
Mm-hmm.
You recognize their frustrations. They will listen a lot more before making a decision, or at least they give the indication that they will listen more without making a decision.
Mm-hmm.
They will confer much more openly with department chairmen. You know, they have their department chairman meetings, and they bring up their problems to department chairman. Well, hell, Fowkes would make the decision to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a real difference there.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe this can...
I don't know if... I can't really answer your question very well in that comparison, but it's a big pattern.
Well, you did make provide an example when we first discussed this concerning something you were involved with in Eau Claire.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's right. This is also a tradition in the College of Ag, and I'm glad you mentioned that because it does demonstrate this. The Cooperative Extension Service is housed through the College of Agriculture. Now, this is a piece of ag that is more, in many respects, is more like education. But one of the problems I ran into as a joint appointment was that when education is loose in terms of its service to the state, ag is tight in terms of its service to the state, in terms of its rules and regulations.
Mm-hmm.
So that when I had a request as a joint appointment to provide a series of lectures up in the Eau Claire area, sponsored by, I believe, the vocational schools. I just don't forget, I'm quite sure it was. I made the mistake of putting the request through to be off campus for a particular series of lectures. And I indicated in the request for which I will be paid an honorarium.
Mm-hmm.
And it went through the dean's office in the College of Ag. Now, the little formal request we used to fill out to be off campus, I could have gone through the School of Education of the College of Ag. Now, in this particular case, it went to the College of Ag. It was clear from the memo that I was going to be paid. And I got the thing back. It was denied. I couldn't be paid. Well, it didn't make any difference to me. Really. They had offered to pay me, and I wasn't about to turn it down. But it really didn't make that much difference. So I called the person, chairman of committee. It seems to me it was some integrated group. It might have been more than the vocational school. And indicated that I couldn't be paid for this. Well, I discovered that I think almost on the spur of the moment, the person I was talking to may have made this decision. On the other hand, it might have been policy, saying, well, it is our policy to pay people that come up for these series of lectures, and that we're going to insist that we get your service and we pay for it. So I called the dean's office. I think Froker was the dean at the time. And I told him the problem I was having on this. Well, he said, you're a joint appointment. Maybe next time you should put the request through education. I don't think they will do this. And so I checked with the dean, which I think was Fowkes. And, he said for things like that, you're supposed to get some consulting fees once in a while. But he said, sure, you can do it without pay too. But in the meantime, they'd made a decision up there, and I'd gotten a letter or a phone call, I don't recall which, saying if it's the policy of the College of Agriculture not to allow us to pay, it was a rural type series of lectures I was doing. It may even have had to do with reorganization for all I know. We've decided we have to go elsewhere, so we will bring in a staff person that we had as second on the list from Northwestern University.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, fine, you do that. Now, I learned my lesson. I never put such requests through ag after that. I put them through education.
Mm-hmm.
And It really, I think, it really stems from the fact that ag appointments that went out into the state were extension appointments in which your service to the state was part of your service as an extension agent. Now, I wasn't an extension agent. They have not made a distinction between those. Back when I was an extension in Minnesota, you know, I would never have thought of getting paid for anything because that was part of my extension activity. But when I was on the campus faculty, I did. I'd still do it both ways. I have an interesting, in fact, I'll throw this in here, and it may or may not be useful to anybody else. I think this experience with the College of Ag on that was the trigger to build a little personal policy on this that I have used over the years. When someone calls in, and I still get a lot of calls for lectures and so on, both in-state and out-of-state, when someone calls from in-state and asks for this, I will never ask in advance if they're going to pay. I will determine whether or not I can do it. And I will tell them I can do it. Usually then they will say, well, they'll either say, well, we're not really able to pay you, or they will say, how much is the fee going to be? And then I have a policy. I say, well, this is in Wisconsin. You can do three things. You cannot pay me at all. And this was established back when we had travel budgets. I think right now I would probably not have three alternatives because we'd have to get travel from them. But I'd say there are three alternatives. One is nothing at all, and I'll put the travel on my School of Education budget or College of Ag budget. I could get them either way. those were the days. Or you can pay round-trip transportation and, you know, the meals and lodging if I have to stay overnight. Or you pay me a professional fee. Now, that professional fee throws them. And they'll say, what is a professional fee? And a professional fee moved over the years from $50 plus expenses to $100 plus expenses for a lecture. If it happens to be a night one and I stay overnight, if it's far out, you know, the expense gets up around $150, $200. I discovered very early on that, and I was getting requests to speak at county-sponsored extension activities, which was interesting, because extension then would ask the question, and I would give them the alternative, you see, of no pay and of a professional honorarium. And then they would wonder how they could get it out of their budget. And it really caused policy discussions at the county level. I also discovered one thing, that the more you got to a disadvantaged area, the more they were willing to pay the professional fee. If I got a call from Rock County, one of the wealthiest counties in the state, from their extension, and indeed I did, they were the ones that would take it for free. So I ended up believing that they were wealthy counties because they were just like wealthy people. They saved all their money and didn't spend it on foolish things like Kreitler lectures.
Of course, not only has there been relationships to the agricultural school, but over the years, of course, part of the reputation of the school of education has been in its supposedly in its ties to the College of Letters and Science, and a lot of the NCATE matter revolved around just that issue. Perhaps you could comment a little bit about your perceptions of the changing involvement of letters and science in the School of Education since you've been here.
I'll give you only one or two sentences on it, because again, it's not because I'm not involved in certification to any extent.
Okay.
It's not something in which I've been close to. The one observation I would make is that at School of Education faculty meetings, mm-hmm. which I attend as few times as I possibly can, but by doing it less often than most over a period of years, I can honestly say that the involvement of letters and science faculty in School of Education faculty meetings has become less and less and less. I did go to the faculty meeting a couple weeks ago, and although there were a few people I didn't know who may indeed have been from letters and science, it was primarily a departments in the School of Education, in the teacher training program, plus a half a dozen of us from CABE, not teacher training, who were at that meeting. Mm-hmm. And I recall times when we would meet, School of Education faculty meeting over in the multimedia auditorium in the old Ed building, when 50% or more of the discussions involved comments by letters and science faculty who were nominal members of the School of Education. Mm-hmm. Think for example, the leadership of Bob Pooley in English, who I don't believe was in a department of education, I don't think he was in our department. But I would always see him at the School of Education faculty meetings in leadership roles. There were quite a number of others of that type during the 50s and early 60s that I think had represented considerable influence mm-hmm. by letters and science. I think the influence is less. Now, I'm judging this on the basis of their involvement in faculty meetings. Mm-hmm. Now, I may be wrong. It may just have been the ones I sat in on, which I admit are few, embarrassingly few, only if I feel I should be there, and I don't feel I should be there, so I'm not embarrassed.
Okay. Well, perhaps I can get you also to comment a little bit about something that should be a little more close to home, and that's just sort of evaluate briefly some of the changes in the old Department of Education, then within the later the various departments of education that you've been involved in terms of how they've dealt with incoming faculty and current faculty and this sort of thing, and just a general analysis.
Okay. I will compare the early years of my tenure. And let me just take the role of an assistant professor. Mm-hmm. The role of an assistant professor when I joined the faculty in 49 compared to the role of the assistant professor now, and I'll make this comparison because I'm involved with a number of assistant professors, is shows a far greater concern and pressure for promotion now than it did then. It may be because the perception is it's harder to get now than it was then. But there is an involvement of department faculty with assistant professors in a sense in trying to aid them so that they understand what it takes to get tenure. There were no formal committees for new assistant professors back when I was an assistant professor. Mm-hmm. That started off the first year they were on campus. Now, for example, in CAVE and in Ed Policy Studies, both of where I am faculty members, when a new assistant professor comes, a committee of three senior faculty are appointed, in a sense, to talk with this person, to try to help that person see what he or she will need to do if they're on tenure track to gain tenure. It's a kind of a helping relationship. Now you see, there must indeed be a number of factors that have caused that to occur. Mm-hmm. It isn't just out of the goodness of my heart that I'm on four such committees. Mm-hmm. We need the committees now. back when I was in this, okay. I don't even remember a committee of three or any number being appointed to aid the assistant professor through to promotion earlier than 5-6 years ago that wasn't appointed after they had been here 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
See, now they appoint them in policy studies and in CAVE the first year. This is a very recent thing in both departments. Yes, there used to be committees appointed. You know, so-and-so is probably going to be up for promotion in a year or two. We need a committee to help bring these things together, and if there's going to be a recommendation, to make a recommendation to the department.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference in day and between, like, day and night between this.
Do you think that came out of the problem the School of Education had in the mid-60s with getting people past the Social Studies Divisional Committee?
There were problems in the 60s with a standardization of criteria, I believe I would call it, in the Social Science Executive Committee. And indeed, there could be a relationship with that, because that may have been the basis upon which faculty and assistant professors could see more clearly what they were to be judged upon.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been, although there were statements before, they have been becoming more explicit through the years. Almost like all of education, it's gotten to the point where, you know, I think I'm going to raise a concern here. I've never thought about it this way in relation to Social Science Executive Committee. But it almost looks like we're getting it so formalized, so explicit, that you now have to program yourself for promotion. And it's becoming that there's less opportunity for creative endeavor. Because creative endeavor may indeed fall outside of the explicit guidelines of the Social Science Executive Committee and the expectations which in turn have been laid on the departments.
It's also risky.
To go outside of those guidelines. Yes, I think you're right. It's also risky. It's the crystallization of education it's competency-based education at its worst.
Mm-hmm.
You know, competency-based promotion. Anything that you can measure that explicitly is probably not worth measuring.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, well, it hasn't gotten that bad yet.
Mm-hmm.
on promotion. But really, it's moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many pages? Nobody dares to say that that's related to promotion. But maybe only if you're in philosophy of education, maybe you only need to produce on an average of 30 pages of written documents a year. But if you're in CAVE, you need to produce 150.
Mm-hmm.
Because CAVE is service oriented and philosophy of education is theory development. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It may end up that way. We're certainly moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if I were, if I were a young professor now, I guess the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, and I would adjust to criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I think that's dangerous.
What about putting yourself back in your role as incoming professor in 1949 and 1979? How then do you perceive the balance of teaching and research and the concepts of service to the state and that sort of thing?
Okay, now as far as I'm concerned, an awful lot of this I think is personal,
mm-hmm.
one's own philosophy. I think I have held the same perception on that as far as I'm concerned, mm-hmm. throughout the years. And I'll describe it, and I will indicate that as far as I'm concerned, I believed in the role of a professor who was researcher, teacher, disseminator, or service.
Mm-hmm.
I made a very crucial decision the year before I came to Wisconsin. I was offered in 1948, knowing a person knew in Minnesota knew that I was within a couple months of my completion of my thesis. They knew I was looking for positions as a professor. I was offered a high-level administrative position at Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Jumping 2-3 steps of a normal move in a career.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only tough, it's really, I guess, the only tough professional decision I've ever had to make. I had to decide what I wanted to do with my life, whether I wanted to be an administrator or whether I wanted to be a professor.
Mm-hmm.
And at that particular time, following 3 years of graduate study, I felt I was in a good position to make the decision, although it was not an easy decision. You know, there's an awful lot that comes in. God, you know, you get this important position. Financially, you'll never get that as an assistant professor. All kinds of things. So it took me 6 weeks to make the decision. I had time to make it, thank goodness. I might have made it incorrectly. But during that period, I decided the kind of role I wanted to play much more clearly than I ever had before.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I pretty much said, I think I'm good enough to be a researcher, teacher, disseminator, even though I'll have problems with all three. I wasn't a good enough writer. I knew I had writing problems. And that if that's what I want to be, I have to be at a major institution. I will never get the chance to do the research I want to do if I'm not at a major institution. And I believe that if, and this is what I hold to, that if a person really believes in doing research, that person will do research whether he has time for research or not. And that at a major institution, if you're doing research, you can teach reasonably well, and I had no question at all about my teaching, even though I'm criticized. I still have no doubts about it.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can learn to disseminate, provide service more effectively, I had no trouble with oral dissemination. I had trouble with written dissemination. And if I could learn to do that more effectively, I should be able to handle a professor's role in any major university.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said to myself, if I can't do all three, I know I can teach, and I will hold in abeyance the possibility that I will not find myself in a situation where I have so much trouble that my life isn't worth living.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, I will go to a teaching institution, teacher's college,
mm-hmm.
or something. But I was convinced that I could do it this way. Now, I've since, I think I would reconfirm this, that if a person can do competent research, can teach well, and is convinced of a dissemination role for his research, under those conditions, that person can make it at any major institution. Now, the person who comes to Wisconsin and is really uncomfortable with research, God, shouldn't come here.
Mm-hmm.
They really shouldn't come here. They should go to some other institution. And that's one of the key ingredients I try to check with when we interview assistant professors. I don't think they're going to have a problem if they're researchers.
Mm-hmm.
And a major institution is a research institution. You know, we can get the most qualified, service-oriented person who really can communicate and can't do research. They're going to have a heck of a time getting through this institution. Or you take a person who, and I could name colleagues over the years, by the way, right at this institution, who live a life that I wouldn't want to live. And these are the people who are here on campus working nights. They're here on campus working weekends. Now, I've forgotten things often enough, come back from conferences often enough, to stop at my office to see who's here nights when I pick up things. I don't work here weekends or nights. Weekends when I teach classes, that's different. That's my service orientation coming through. My God, the same people are here putting in 80, 90 hours a week trying to keep up with the rigors of this institution. Well, this goes back to my early decision. If I had to do that, I'd be out of here. Mm-hmm. Now, there were times when I was really involved in this reorganization controversy and research when, sure, I was working 70, 80 hours a week, but I was enjoying every minute of it. But when those particular cycles die down, if I can't do my job, and this was way back in that early decision, if I couldn't do my job in a reasonable average work period, this is not the institution for me. And I think that still holds true for new assistant professors. But they've got to want to do research, or this isn't the place for them.
Well, the question would be, is it possible for them now, with all the different demands on them, and the explicitness of those demands, to be able to put that kind of control on themselves?
Yes.
It is.
Yes. They don't want to control themselves as much. In other words, it takes both the intent, and it does take discipline. Now, I'm thinking of an assistant professor on whose committee I am on now. I'll take two of them, because I'm on committees of one who indeed fits the pattern I've described. He is, you know, it might take him longer than it took me to make it, because it takes longer these days. You know, you don't really put him up in 3 years. But this in 3 years, this fellow, there's going to be no question that he's going to make tenure. Sure, we won't put him up until he's been here, you know, into that second three-year period. But there's another person who actually is busier, who is doing more things all the time, that is going to have an awful time making it. Because that person is just not disciplining the time. It takes that personal discipline. And I'd almost suggest that the crucial ingredient of my disciplining myself was that administrative decision. You know, it goes right back to these days, I call it a decision. I think the modern social psychologists would call it a life crisis. Which I really had a tough decision to make as to whether I'd go administration. But I think that decision then helped me put other things into focus. Now, it may well be that these two assistant professors I'm talking about, one indeed may have had, you know, may have grown into it naturally, or may have made a certain kind of conscious or unconscious decision that says, I do these things, I don't do these things, I work on something to this point. For example, I'm not a perfectionist. And I can handle something that's 80% as good as I can get it. Now, some people can't. Now, the difference between doing something in terms of the potential it provides for the field, something that's done 80% as well as I could do it, probably has 99% of the effectiveness of doing that extra 20%. Now, doing that extra 20% for me would take as much time as doing the 80%. And I use the point of diminishing returns. I'm very cold and cruel and calculating on that. And I can happen to handle controversy. I can handle complaints and jibes that you really weren't very careful in your final analysis, were you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I wasn't quite as careful as I could have been, but I've got the major thrust. Oh yes, you have the major thrust, but shouldn't you have done this? I could have done this, but I don't have time. Well, not that I don't have time, I don't take the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think each individual is a little different on that, but I know professors who are perfectionists.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, with some exceptions, I don't think the perfectionist has the influence, or the real influence that a person has who does twice as much at 80%.
Mm-hmm.
I just pulled 80% out of the hat, but you know, maybe it's 90%.
Yeah.
Five more minutes. What are you going to ask me that I can give you some quickies on?
Well, I thought maybe we could wind up. Well, first, maybe you can talk a little bit about how student-faculty relations have changed a little bit over time, and then conclude with a little bit about your changing role here in the School of Education.
Okay. In terms of student-faculty relationships, there are a great deal of variations now among departments.
Mm-hmm.
That I can see. If I go back to the early 50s, there was a very, very positive student-faculty relationship. Here was a period when we had a sufficient number of young professors who weren't that far removed from the grad students coming in, the World War II vets,
because mm-hmm.
some of us were World War II vets, got done early, came on to faculty, other vets were coming in. It was really a big and a new experience for a lot of people who had never really planned to go to graduate school. They were an appreciative group.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the 50s had, I guess, what I would call an appreciative graduate student body. I'm not going to talk about undergraduates. I've had little relationship to them. The School of Education, the Department of Education, had graduate student organizations that were viable.
Mm-hmm.
I still have a picture somewhere in my files that I think demonstrates the example and the naivete of that was there to develop the closeness that existed between faculty and students. This was a student party held in Great Hall of the Union, and to which faculty were invited. And Paul Eberman, Estvan, whatever Estvan's name was.
Frank
Estvan, Paul Eberman, Kreitlo, and I forget who the other person. No, we were the three, I think. But there were others. The students had asked us to do certain things as part of the program.
Mm-hmm.
So Estvan and Eberman and Kreitlo were the three Andrews sisters, and the students provided all of the wigs and everything else. And here we were with a microphone. None of us could sing, which was, and I'm sure they chose us for that reason. You know, there was an esprit de corps
mm-hmm.
that demonstrates. Now, to give you the equal of that, and this may disappear,
mm-hmm.
the present graduate student group in CAVE is very similar.
Mm-hmm.
This is a group that has a grad student organization. They publish a monthly newsletter. They sponsor lectures. They sponsor picnics to which faculty are invited. They provide the actual recommendations, not just a panel of students to be on committees.
Mm-hmm.
This organization gives to the department chairman their decision on which students shall be on faculty committees, grad exam committee, all the way through. personnel committee and so on. Mm-hmm. And the students are on and take active part in the committees. Now, I do not see the same thing in ed policy studies. Mm-hmm. And it could be that I'm missing something, but I don't see it. Mm-hmm. I do go to meetings over there, and I tend to see almost a different relationship between students and faculty mm-hmm. than I do in CAVE. Now, part of it, you see, is the foundation area with its, I guess I'll say this, its prima donnas mm-hmm. in each specialty. That's almost, that's putting it strongly, but the specialties are more specialized in the foundations. It's a combination of categories into that faculty rather than a combination of persons with a common thrust. And there's the difference between EPS and CAVE. Mm-hmm. Indeed, I think CAVE has, well, it has a bimodal thrust, but they're very close together, vocational and continuing. Mm-hmm. There's just an awful lot of overlap. I just don't see the overlap. Now, I think it's demonstrated in students. Now, going back to the early 50s, this was when the Department of Education was small enough to really have a common thrust of graduate education, mm-hmm. even though there were special fields, as there still are in CAVE. CAVE right now is more like the early Department of Education that I experienced. Mm-hmm. It's really an interesting phenomenon. If you hadn't asked the question, I would never have made the comparison.
Of course, too, as I understand the nature of graduate training in the early 1950s was considerably different in that it required a broad
training. That's right. And it did indeed require a broad training. And right now, there certainly is more specialized training in ed policy studies than in CAVE, although CAVE has its own specialized training as well. They do identify their foundation areas that are common, tend to be common to all students, and that may indeed have some advantage. Mm-hmm. But they do go their own way, and there are a lot of differences. There's still a lot of differences in the specialization, so it isn't totally that. Now, going to the other departments, I think they fit somewhere. I really think I'm in two departments that are at the extremes of this. Mm-hmm. Because I do run into grad students in C&I. They're not as viable as CAVE, but I don't think they're as disorganized as Ed Policy Studies. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then you wanted to go to what other item?
Well, you said you'd like to talk a little bit about how your role has changed as a member of the school education.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I don't think I'll say much about this. If anything, my role in the School of Education really has changed with the changing of the departmental structures. Mm-hmm. I was playing a much broader role across specialties in the early days because we were all in the Department of Education. Mm-hmm. I certainly had a closer tie and a closer role with Ed Administration, which has dropped completely. I don't think I want to go into it, actually. It basically is a change from a generalist in education to a specialist whose primary focus has been continuing education for the last 10 years. And right. Where the initial was split between rural and adult, rural and continuing, the rural tended, you see, to hit all of the other areas. Mm. It was just a kind of a piece that, as a specialty, was never going to get any bigger. Mm-hmm. And I recognize this. Continuing education, on the other hand, was a field whose time had not yet come when I was, in fact, I was one of the early warning signals that continuing education was going to come mm-hmm. at Wisconsin. And so my role in this has really been one in which the rural part has diminished to the point where 10% of my time might be spent in relationships of that type. An occasional course. I haven't taught a course in it now. I really find somebody else to do it, mm-hmm. because I'm so involved in adult. And also in adult, different aspects have taken my attention because I've been here through the whole development, and as each new field developed, I tended to be the one that would get it started. Just as I'm taking one area that I should have been working on in research for the last 5 years that I'm going to take into retirement with me in research, and that is the area of gerontology. Mm. We should have started this at Wisconsin 5 years ago. We developed the interest in it, but it's done interdisciplinary now through the Macbeth Institute, which is fine. It's an appropriate way to do it because we got caught in developing that for the simple reason you no longer can get funds. Mm-hmm. Adult basic education started about 10 years ago. This special area of adult education, literacy training, should have had its full-time faculty member 5 years ago. That's when I had a full load in that area, was ready to turn it over. The first time in my career, we couldn't add a staff person. Okay, so I continue to carry that. I should have started developing gerontology then, which by now would be an established, we would have been one of the major institutions in training for education of older adults. Mm-hmm. Now we're just another institution in that. And so that's where my research is going to carry me. I have a long-term plan on this, or at least 10 years, mm-hmm. and it starts this summer.